I am Marilyn McCarney. Betsy Payette and I are interviewing personnel who were instrumental in developing Renfrew Museum and Park. Today is February 26, 1992.
There it goes.
First it says, can I speak to the genesis of Mrs. Nicodemus's idea? Well, remember, we're going back 16, 18 years perhaps, and for many years I kept a box of records that deep, and finally I got to the point that I thought this is crazy to keep all this stuff. So I threw it away. Had I known you would be here some night, I would have kept it all. But
I had a whole folder on Renfrew, which I obviously pitched. I have a newspaper clipping for the past 5, 6 years.
But these are things that happened. But anyway, I think I have a fairly decent memory. And particularly in this question number one, always used to be a very sore spot with me, that to the best of my recollection, only Leroy Maxwell knew about the will and Mrs. Nicodemus's mm-hmm. intentions. Because at the board, I don't think it was pretty shallow, and most people I don't know what the rate is today, but that was one of the very thorny decisions, and there were many, many difficult decisions. I don't think anyone, there was never any kind of hostility ever at the board meeting. Some people may have felt strongly, but it was all done in a very gentlemanly or lady-like manner. The first year or two were really tough, and there were so many things that we had to do in terms of meet the deadline of the will in terms of voting the new man was a big thing. And another thing that in hindsight, probably, in my opinion, might be my personal way of feeling this way, that it probably was a mistake for Mrs. Nicodemus to stipulate that it had to be donated to a government. I think had she set it up as a private trust with the stipulation to be open to the public, it would have been so much better. You didn't have a second layer of management with the town council, which were basically absentee landlords, but always responsible for pushing the buttons, always. Because Andrew was under the municipality, we had to pay what's called union scale wages, which were sometimes 2.5, 3 times more than we could have hired. And you hired the same people, but you had to pay them union wages, which were established in Harrisburg or somewhere, which cost us literally thousands and thousands of dollars. And I'm not sure that some of the regulations we fell under would have been the same had we been private, but access to public as opposed to being under the municipal. And I mean, it's water under the dam, over the dam. I'm sure Leroy had never done anything like this when he set up the state. And this would make some intense work to do it to the town, but in my opinion, also that brought us under the growth wage scale benefit program, all that sort of thing. So it ended up costing thousands of dollars from our money resources. And I guess that was a step in the foot. This is the first time I've ever had to go on the record about it. And whether it ever goes anywhere or not, I don't know that it ever will. But I just many times thought, what if? And also because town council really had to approve all of them through the board's decisions, and meant that anyone from any walk of life could go to their council and make a complaint, and the board would have to answer to that complaint, which never really pleased me. But they're putting on for election, and that's the difference. That off my chest. Okay. In terms of difficult things, I think of personnel struggles in the early years were indeed trying. And one of the reasons I think that happened was because of the way we organized when for the very beginning. And at that time, we set up really two equals, in the curator and in Ed Miller. Ed was to be in charge of the grounds and that sort of thing, and the curator in charge of the exhibit. And you can't have a house with two equals. That does not work. I wonder if our furnaces don't really feel bad about it, because I was the junior member of the board, and Dr. Guyton had a lot of years in terms of management experience at the hospital, and Chet Adams, and I don't think they saw the pitfall of what we did, but that really created, I think, the constant turnover that we had in terms of careers in those early years. And I guess enough said on that subject too, but I think that decision really sowed the seeds for a lot of problems But I, and again, council approved that. And, also, there were some in the early press first year. There were some pretty unpleasant meetings with our board and council trying to figure out the way we're going and to allow them. We had to do it, and they constantly wanted to seem to us backseat drive. Now, in some cases, they were correct, and we should have followed their advice. I remember Joe Cato in particular made some comments one night. Some of these matters. So I think he's passed away now, I guess, but if he were here, I would tell him he was right, give him some satisfaction. Failures, I don't think we had any failures that eventually didn't come around. There were some difficulties that could have gone smoother. One of the things that asked for, and I'd wanted strongly, was to get right away from Summit View School from I guess that's 2nd Street out there, to the upper part of the property for additional parking. And I think someday we have hopes of putting that in the picnic area up there. The school board would let us go across their property. And I think in time that may change too. We don't need it today. But it would be something nice to have, and we'll just have to wait and see. But early on, the school board had asked us, I think, for a pathway for school children to get to Wayne Heights, and we turned them down because we didn't want these kids, because I know what they throw up in front of my house on the way home from school. And we made a mistake, I think, when we turned down the school board, and I think they made a mistake when they turned down us. And one of these days, I hope there will be at least right away across the school board property up there. We'll just have to someday wait to see if it becomes a big issue, and if the voters can be sold on it, I think they in turn will make the school board see the light. It might take 50 years and we'll all be gone, but we'll just have to wait and see. This is what strengths did you perceive in the concept and the tools and the funds. I don't think you'll ever have enough money. Particularly at the very beginning when we had so much to do and we were determined not to go off the principal. We felt that that had to be maintained to use the return. In fact, we borrowed money from the bank and then paid it back. I don't remember what it was anymore, maybe between $20,000 and $30,000, something like that. So I don't think it should be as difficult today again. It used to be around $90,000, I think, was our income, and I'm going to guess it probably hasn't changed a whole lot today. And if it hasn't, that would make it even more difficult to manage because we're going back almost 15 years. But when you take out of there the salary for the staff, there's not usually a great deal left. And but. And of course, it was a generous endowment when you look at the principal, and I think that the Renfrew is well managed and has been. And there again, of course, every year we paid the borough for the use of their trucks. They came out to do something, we had to kick money back to the borough, and that. Or if they did some engineering work, we just had to take their word for it that, well, our bill is $8,000 from the borough to Renfrew. And sometimes our jaws dropped open, but it wasn't like you could go to an outside concern and say, hey, here's what are you going to do for us, and here's what we're going to pay, and that sort of thing. So there again, one of the liabilities of being under the borough. I think under Dick Miller, there was certainly an effort on his part, I think, to give rent for every break that it could get. And again, I wouldn't not being there, not having access to all the information, it's difficult to say, but I think for about 2 years, Renfrew was certainly Dick's main priority as far as the borough manager, getting it open, getting it to function. I think he had to give a lot of answers to town council during that period of time, and I think there's no doubt that Renfrew probably wouldn't be where it is today without having had Dick Miller to work on it. So I think he was a key person in the early years. Surprises, good ones or bad, I think I've already talked about the good ones. Community support, the environmental teaching that's going on at Renfrew today. I've been an environmentalist since I graduated from school. I joined the Sierra Club the first year. I found them to be a little too radical to my liking, but instead of the Sierra Club, at that time joined the Audubon Society, the Nature Conservancy, the National Wildlife Federation. I'm still a member of those organizations. So I believe you pay your dues as you go through life, and that money to those organizations is pretty well spent. So for that reason, I'm always very, very happy when I read the paper, usually about the educational things that are happening. And just recently, I met Mrs. Doris Goldman. I had some photographs that I took at Renfrew of wildflowers. I had no idea what they were. I just like to take pictures. So I went out to her house one evening, and she immediately, this is all in Latin, this and such. And I had no idea that she was out there planting wildflowers. She gave me a computer run of what she's planted, and it's just page after page. So here's a lady that probably her efforts are pretty much unknown, except by probably only a few people in the work that she's doing. So I think it would be tremendous if she can reestablish a lot of these species that were in this area once upon a time and are no longer here. So it seems like Renfrew just continues to draw people, activities. I haven't fished in years. I am now in photography and president of the Antietam Photographic Society. So we have about 2 photography sessions a year at Renfrew, and members just love to come over and traipse around and take pictures. And so it's turned out to be a mecca for activities that I didn't even dream of, 1974, 1975. And I think most of the other board members would make the same statement. To make some comments about the board members, Chet Adams was a very serious man, rarely joked or even smiled that I can remember. Rarely even became involved in the discussions of the board. He would break a tie, but that's it. And if he did feel strongly about something, he would usually say so in 2 or 3 sentences, and that was it. Mr. Bowers was as quiet as Chet, maybe more so. Sometimes would go a whole meeting and not speak. I think, though, he did a lot of things for Renfrew in terms of knowing when antiques were available, knowing what they should be priced. I think he was involved in the appraisal program at Renfrew, which took months, and that was another big deal of unpacking boxes and boxes and trying to decide what was just plain household junk to be sold at a sale. And there were people in the community just up in arms. Well, you can't sell that. That was Mrs. Nicodemus' such a potato masher. Now, we weren't there to preserve Mrs. Nicodemus' household goods. But there were people very close to the museum. And again, I have to be very careful. I want to be careful in what I say. that were just irate at some of these decisions being made by the curators over what was going to be disposed. And of course, that was a reason of conflict, particularly the people that had always been close to Mrs. Nicodemus, had authority when she was alive, and suddenly were, we'll say, slightly displaced. And this was perhaps the most unpleasant and difficult manner that had to be dealt with at that time. And it was, at times, very, very divisive. Helen Huffman, Leroy Maxwell, Dr. Guyton, talkative people. I think Dr. Guyton might have been, if I had to pick someone that perhaps put in more personal time at Renfrew than anyone, and I could be wrong, I'm telling you what I perceived. I would say Dr. Guyton, in terms of being out there hour upon hour of his free time talking with the curators or the consultants. I think he and Helen, probably Leroy, did all the personnel interviews when we had to hire people, which in those years was often. They would, you know, put the ads in the various magazines that would, you know, you don't put an ad for curator in the American Herald. So they knew the magazines were fine arts oriented to put the help wanted ads. They would enter the resumes. You had to fly these people in here for their interviews, all that sort of thing. Also, during those years, from time to time, there were anonymous donations of very nice Bell antiques. And I was on the board and I couldn't find out. But I think it was a board member. I'm certain it was a board member. And I always suspected Dr. Guyton. No, I have no proof other than he had the interest and certainly the financial resources if he chose to do so. But other members of the board were wealthy men, except me. And I'm sure Helen Huffman could have done it, maybe did if she chose, but it would be interesting. And I think that's something that should be explored. And I don't think those records should be sealed forever. And surely it's available to Museum Mass who donated some of those very, very nice pieces because the board at that time simply could not buy them. Someone had the forethought to know that these things are not going to be around forever, because sometimes a collector will buy them and they end up in California, and they're gone. So some of the very key pieces of Bell pottery were put into the collection at that time. We met many nights. I think we floundered for a while until Jim Koenig arrived, and I would put him on a pedestal in terms of a man who literally led the board and forced us to sit down and create the vision that we wanted for Renfrew. And we met upstairs in the town hall. My goodness, I can't remember if it was every one night a week or every other, and it seemed like it went on forever. I mean, month after month, until we decided among ourselves what we were going to do. What did we see? There were ideas like make it a farm machinery museum, because make it a Geyser and Frick museum for the barn. And there were people in the community proposing it to us and to their council members. And it would have been a lovely thing to do. But again, if we had gotten those steam engines and threshers, you have to maintain them and house them. And we felt we were kind of getting a little far afield from what Mrs. McAdams had wanted. But just those ideas sometimes took hours of back and forth. What if? And well, if we do that, then what if? And finally, I think it was decided that the purpose of the barn, that we really needed a visitor center. That, and again, I think Dr. Guyton and Helen Huffman, who'd been to many museums and realized that you need a holding area when you get a lot of people to register them, and you need something there for them to look at until you can get them into the flow. And of course, the first couple of years, we didn't have any restrooms outside, and that was a real dicey situation. Sandy pots. Nobody likes sandy pots. Warm weather, cold weather, anytime. And of course, we couldn't start that plan until we had money. So we finally prioritized things. Here's what we're going to do them in these steps. Another matter came up, and I'll call it a defeat, was the Fonny Stock House. And I think our opinion, and I say our, and I think I'm speaking for the board, maybe not the entire board, but I think the majority. Was just plain junk, and the sooner it fell down, the better off everyone would be. And therefore, we had no intentions of fixing the roof or doing anything to it. And I think we passed a resolution, or we appropriated some money to do something to the stone portion. Well, of course, it made the press, and the local historical society, primarily Tom Dorsett, Marion Grove, and the other lady who's now, I guess, on and if it is fixed up, I don't know how in the world anyone can ever secure it against vandalism, that sort of thing. I mean, the barn's one thing, but windows in a house are something else, because we had additional vandalism after Smith Eames died. In spite of our efforts, you couldn't keep kids from going in there and doing all sorts of things. So I'll say that's one that we lost. Again, perhaps not all the board members felt that way, but I know some of them, because we often couldn't speak at the meetings because the press was always there. But we could often, in the hall, prior to one would call the other one over and say, "We get in there. Here's what we're going to do." There were times, though, that when we were discussing a delicate issue, Chet Adams would usually say to the reporter, he said, "Now, I'm going to ask for your indulgence. Now, this is a very delicate matter, and if you report our discussions, it's possible that people will be hurt, or the board members, and we'd like to be able to speak our mind. Now, you're more than willing, or, please go ahead and report on what we do, but on this particular matter, would you please give us the liberty of speaking freely? And in every case, the reporter, and there were many of them over the years, said whatever you say is off the record, and they never broke their word. So that, to me, was very, very nice. And before I was on the board, I was a great proponent of the Sunshine Law. And afterward, now I think it's terrible, because I do think boards must have a right to discuss without... Now, you can close to the reporter if you're discussing about personnel. That's the only, you know, hiring, firing, that's the only reason you can ask the reporter to leave and close the meeting to the public. But it certainly puts the board members in a difficult situation. It forces them to call each other on the phone to discuss things. And that's bad, because then you have two or three people discussing things and they're not in the presence of the other board members. So that was something that I really didn't care for, and I think our well-intentioned lawmakers made a mistake. Although, and I'm sure they don't subject themselves to that same law in Harrisburg. I'd be very, very surprised. I think we've pretty much covered most of these questions. If you have any that you'd like to ask, that you think that perhaps I didn't cover in depth. Some years later, I'm going to guess early 80s, the Fish Commission changed the rules, and now they stock it, and you can keep, I think, three a day perhaps, or something like that, because they found that the water, particularly with these droughts we're having, that they wanted it to be initially a trophy fishing area, but they simply couldn't maintain that level of fishing. So it's been changed, and I don't think it's done any harm. If anything, more people fish now than did in the past. Another, even though you're not particularly dealing, you asked me about the early board. Now, I Willard Ron was placed on the board while I was still on the board, and I think he was a tremendous addition to the board, very soft-spoken man. I particularly was pleased because I think his primary interest was also in the park as opposed to the museum, and I hope I'm not judging him, but I think he would probably tell you that. And his interest in birds and his bird walks, I think, were a tremendous addition, and still are a tremendous addition to Renfrew. And I think other things have happened, like the book by Dan Arthur and Ron Kuiper, the photography is certainly tremendous. Not everyone likes black and white, but I think that there's just a tremendous feel in here. And I talked to Dan Arthur about it, and he was more than helpful in telling me how he did it, the use of the very special film and his techniques, and someday I hope to be able to duplicate his work. One thing that did surprise me a little bit, when I was on the board, I seem to recall where we had a motion one day that, well, first let me tell you about the origin of the wild area on the east side of the Antietam. We were talking about money and time, and Ed was explaining that now that it was after the 1st of July, he would have to mow the meadow on the east side of the Antietam. And I remember saying, Ed, why do you have to mow it? And he said, well, if we don't mow it, it will grow up in weeds. And I said, what in the world is wrong with weeds? And he said, they're unsightly, the neighbors will complain. And again, you've got to remember that Ed was a farmer. That's his background. And farmers hate weeds, and they hate rock breaks. They like a nice, clean farm. So very quickly, I believe Dr. Guyton and Emily Roy Maxwell, I think, often was an ally to me, because he would say, hey, look, Pat's been very patient as we've done all this stuff with the museum. Now, by golly, he's right. and we have to do something for the park. So on that day, I can't remember if it was Leroy or Dr. Guyton picked it up first. Doggone it, that's a good idea. Why don't we let it go back to the rabbits and the birds and that sort of thing? And boy, Ed just had a terrible time with that. He said, I'll have to talk to the neighbors and maybe I can keep a swath mowed around there. And we finally reached a compromise that it would at least be a trial balloon for a period. Well, and within about a year, I remember one cold day, Leroy and Ed were out there as volunteers planting trees in that area. But it's so wet that only one or two of them grew. We were all so disappointed. We just didn't pick the right species for that area. So, and of course we should know better because we dug some of the holes and we filled up with water right away. But I don't think Ed's pretty good at planting corn, but perhaps not at planting trees. So anyway, by that time, it was pretty firmly established that that would be a region that we let go back to nature. And I think it was about a year later, or perhaps two, and I can't tell you exactly because I don't remember, that I said, look, why are we still farming? Yes, it brings in money, but people can see tens of thousands of acres of cornfields in alfalfa here in Franklin County. People aren't going to come to Renfrew to look at a cornfield. Now, why don't we gradually plant, in trees, the whole area other than this piece, which is between the museum and the Fawney Stockhouse and Barn, because it's very important to see across that as a matter of. And the board agreed, and I was certain we'd put it in a motion that we would attempt to get out of farming as soon as possible to allow the land to return to its more natural state as a place for wildlife and bugs and butterflies and whatever wanted to live there. And it was a bit of a surprise to me when I got this book because there was a statement in here as to the intent of the board in regards to the land itself. And it's kind of, I guess, a statement, if I can find it. It says that it was settled evidently in December of 1979. It was called a vegetation plan. It was prepared by a board member, Nick Hunter, who I recall was affiliated with Penn State campus at Mount Alto, and said that that all land east of the Antietam Creek, except the temporary picnic area and the auto parking lot, are to be permitted to grow its natural way, supplemented by planned planting. B, that the ravine wilderness planting area west of the Antietam Creek is to be permitted to grow its natural way with the existing walkways. Well, this evidently was a bit of a reversal because that's saying the woods area will remain natural and only the land east of the Antietam Creek. So I can only hope that one of these days maybe the board will see fit to change that. I think the income used to be about $40 an acre. And we'll guess there might be 80 or 90 acres, and I'm sure that's money because every bit counts. But I'm also wondering if the community, which was so generous in the past, not be willing to do something to allow Renfrew to grow up in that region. We'll just have to wait and see. And the other thing that I started to propose, I talked to Herb Frantz last fall. I was photographing his corn shocks. And I asked him if he would consider farming Renfrew with horses. And he said yes, he would if he had the opportunity. So I think if the board wants to farm it, what better opportunity than to allow kids and the people to come and watch with the horses. And I'd love to see that field and corn shocks and pumpkins. That would be a vision. I'd spend a week out there taking pictures of the Fawney Stock Barn. So I didn't make phone calls at time and time. I talked to a couple, I think one or two board members, but I didn't really I guess, go about it the right way. But maybe you ladies could mention this idea through your resources, and if you can vision that, I think it would be really a tremendous opportunity for the children of today who've never seen a field in the corn shocks with the frost and snow on it. And I think Mr. Frost would certainly be an excellent steward of the land if you look at his farm. I think I'd rather see that than last summer. They had a tractor up there during the drought, pumping tremendous quantities of water, and there were just big ruts being washed down through the cornfield. When I asked not to be reappointed, I also kind of made a vow to keep my mouth shut, because I think it always bothered me, people who did not participate, did not work, were the ones who wanted to tell you how to do things. So since I've been off the board, I have never gone back to say, here's what you want to do, because I really feel that I lost that right because I no longer work as I did before. I think if you work, you have the right, and if you don't, you should be quiet. So I've been asked to, if I do a photography seminar, I think, for the Institute, and I said I'd be happy to. So if I do some work, then give me a right to sound off. And the other thing I'd like to mention is that I realized the significance of being on the first board at the very beginning, because I knew we would be the ones to chart the course. And that's probably another reason why I didn't feel really bad when I had to leave the board, was because I felt that the work was firmly established. We had a foundation, and for the most part, things would go on as we had planned initially. So even though I, in a way, was sad that things didn't work out, that I could stay on the board, I enjoy Renfrew more today than I ever did then, because it's all fun and no work. And I go out there very, very often.